Monster Crush is a horny, lighthearted dating show by and for people who love monsters a lot. All monsters are presumed to be of age and are presumed to have given enthusiastic consent in our fictional fuckery. Take care of yourself when listening and see our episode description for all content warnings. Welcome to Monster Crush, a podcast that's a little spooky, always sexy, surprisingly educational. Every episode, we dare to find love in all the wrong places on our never-ending quest for the best monster smooches. I'm joined, as always, by the lovely LD. And speaking of all the wrong places, boy, do I have some wrong places for you today, LD.
No, I hate that transition. No, it's going to be great.
I have today some fearsome critters. Happy fearsome critter episode.
Yay, fearsome critters. Oh, yay, good. Fearsome critters.
I say that like it's a holiday. It's not. We've been doing holiday episodes. Now. Yeah, it is now. It's happy fearsome critter day, whatever this happens to be, as of recording April 15th. I have another themed episode coming up soon. I try to, like, you know, look at what's going to happen and see how I can work that into our schedule. But this was one of those where it's like, it's not a particularly, like, even numbered episode or, like, a really big episode number. And it's just, I thought it was a really great time to bring monsters that I've been talking about for a long time. A couple fearsome critters we've even covered in the past that I'll talk about here in a minute. But just cover some fearsome critters. So I should ask before we go any further, do you know what a fearsome critter is?
In my head, when I think of fearsome critter and in connection with, like, Monster Crush, I think of maybe the jackalope,
absolutely.
Right. Yeah. I don't necessarily consider fearsome. When you put the word critter somewhere, though, I must say, don't automatically, I'm probably not going to smooch any of these critters unless it's like smooch them on your head because they're so cute and I want to eat them sort of smooching.
That is fair. So, I mean, we do have in our little intro to every episode that we presume that all monsters are of age and are able to give enthusiastic consent, because sometimes with monsters, you get things that are a little more on the animalistic side. Mm-hmm. And we always presume, like, technically, you know, you look at something like Nessie. You look at the Loch Ness Monster. If Nessie's a plesiosaur, that's an animal. Like, we don't condone bestiality here on Monster Crush, but we do condone monster smooching. And that is inherently based in the sense that all monsters have the ability to consent and do consent to our monster smooching.
Right, but when you assign the word critter to them, that changes things.
I love the word critter.
Critter's such a great word. I love the word critter, but I'm just saying that, you know, when you look at a creature,
sure,
a creature is different than a critter. And that's, I'm just saying, I can smoosh a critter perhaps not. So we'll see how this goes.
What's the first animal that comes to mind when you hear the word critter?
I mean, like a rabbit, and not a bunny, okay. A rabbit. Those are different. Like, I mean, like, bunnies are critters, but, like, you know, I just think of, like, those, like, really scrawny jackrabbits and things that, like, hang out in the middle of the desert.
They got, like, a little bit of mange on them.
Maybe a possum.
Possum, that's the first one. Possums and raccoons, that's what I think of when I think of a critter. Yeah. Just something that hisses at you in the night when your flashlight hits its little beady eyes. You go, just something like that, yeah.
Exactly like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about fearsome critters are an entirely separate subcategory of monsters. So when we talk about, you know, like, wet ones is a whatever. That's what the term that we use when we talk about lake monsters.
Right.
That's a separate category when we talk about variety of different things. When we talk about, you know, dragon monsters or whatever else. When we talk about, you know, like Bigfoot and how Bigfoot has all these different variations as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which some might argue that Bigfoot might even fall into the fearsome critter category in some ways. But fearsome critters are specifically monsters that come to us from tall tales. In the same sense as, like, technically, Babe the Blue Ox might fall into the category as being a fearsome critter. A little less fearsome because Babe kind of has the benevolent hero sense in the story, right? Right? Everybody
does. Babe is such a good,
Babe is a good, mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
That's all I got.
That's what the spider put in the web. I've gone layers down on that one.
We're going down this hellhole together. Pig.
Okay, so fearsome critters specifically come to us from logging camps, and you know, the people that inhabited them being, you know, loggers. So they were an integral part of the oral tradition of North American logging camps during, you know, late 1800s into the 20th century, and so these monsters were basically just made up by bored blue-collar workers who were out in the middle of nowhere, and they have a variety of purposes to them, which is always one of the things I find fascinating about monsters, mm-hmm. is why does this monster exist? So, oftentimes, in the sense of tall tales, just stories to pass the time. A lot of times, these monsters were jokes, like joke stories you could play on somebody, especially the new guy in camp, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Especially if you had somebody to play off of. A lot of the books about fearsome critters talk about the best way to spread a fearsome critter story is get your confederate in the audience, right? To corroborate, to validate what you're saying. Yeah. So you make a casual remark about a strange noise, and then you turn to, you know, Wiley Jeff right next to you, and he goes, "Oh, I done heard what that is right there." Oh, Wiley Jeff. And that's the other thing, is all of these stories often involve the most ridiculously named human being you can imagine, mm-hmm. who is like the lone survivor of these things, or like the one person who encountered these things. You often have that one person, mm-hmm. who sounds real, so you can, you know, oh, my cousin's brother's, you know, nephew saw this thing, but he has a name, and you can, you know, validate the story that way. So, you know, that even falls into like the snipe hunt sort of deal. Like, oh, you heard that noise. You should go check it out, new mm-hmm. guy. Maybe there's something out there. You could figure out what that noise is. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, spit something erroneous into the fire. They also were sometimes used as explanations for, you know, natural phenomena, again, strange noises in the woods that weren't necessarily meant to, like, you know, pick on people, but just, oh, you know, every now and then I hear this weird whistling noise. Maybe it's a weird monster that makes a whistling noise.
Of course.
On the darker side of things, it might have been an explanation for the loggers who don't come back and are never found. Mm-hmm. You know, a handful, intentionally or not, even mirror depictions of actual animals. There's some fearsome critters that actually do have qualities to them that, unbeknownst at the time, actually reflected real life animals. There's one in particular, the mangrove killifish, takes up shelter in decaying branches and leaves the water, which actually exhibits similarities to the upland trout, which is a legendary fish purported to nest in trees. So you have a real fish. Yeah, you have a real fish that actually is able to, some in a pseudo sort of way, traverse on land by moving through branches, and it kind of in a way mirrored this like legendary fish. Oh, and then, like, you know, you'd also have things like taxidermy things, like jackalope that we've talked about.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So the stories spread in the best way. What's the best form of advertising?
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth, exactly.
Sorry. It's very slow.
It's okay.
I work in theater, which, granted, we also say word of mouth is the best way to talk about a show. I mean, it's certainly how we talk about things. It's just like, I have spent the last 8 hours tying very little tiny knots in a wig, right? And so, like, anything that's like more than 2 feet in front of my face, I'm like, what is happening?
I was gonna say, it's after 8 o'clock on a Monday. I'm asking a lot of LD on this one.
This should be my normal, but I'm not usually like this whole 9 to 5 thing is like weird. So here we are.
We're doing great. This is why I cut out the weird spaces sometimes.
Yes.
The story spread by word of mouth, and that's, you know, also why you get those narrators who the term that I saw used was keep the ball in the air, where they, you're playing back and forth with the story.
Yeah.
But also at that point, you are able to take one story and say a lumberjack goes to a new camp, bring that story with them, and then that person, somebody else picks up the story there, takes it to another camp. So you get these variations on the story as well, where there's no real true authority on what one of these things really are. And it kind of like grew to that point where you would have such great variations on these things that we're not exactly sure how many variations there really were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in that time, the way that Fearsome Critters survived to this day is there were several books that were published. Notably among them was William T. Cox, who wrote The Fearsome Creatures of the Lumber Woods in 1910.
Good old Bill Cox.
I believe he was like head of conservation in Minnesota or Missouri or something. I didn't look up a ton on him because I could find literally nothing about the next author and it felt unfair.
Fair enough.
But the person who really gets a lot of credit and coined the phrase fearsome critter is Henry H. Tryon, and found almost nothing about him besides the fact that he wrote this book, but coined the phrase fearsome critter, collected a lot of the stories, and a lot of the stuff that he writes in that book is still, you know, kind of borrows from a lot of the other books that came before, but points to a lot of the more authority on these creatures. And he even says in his book, again, 1939, this is one of the quotes, "Much true folklore was born, lived, and died with no chance of ever becoming a part of our permanent records. Without doubt, this has happened to a good bit of woods lore."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because so much of what we say, if it's not written down, it gets lost.
It is the sad part about oral traditions, is that all of those beautiful little nuances tend to get lost.
Yeah. Yeah, but we hold on to a little bit. And even with that, there are some monsters who still do to this day have variations that are great enough that they survived. Like the Wampus Cat. It's not
the
one we're going to cover.
The Wampus Cat!
Yeah. Wampus Cat is one of those where if you look up the Wampus Cat, you're going to find at least 3, probably more variations on what this creature actually is. You know, some it's an aquatic panther. Some it has these, the word is pantographic forelimbs, which I had to look up what that word meant. And it basically means they like interlock at strange angles. And I couldn't describe it if I could. Just look up the word pantographic and you'll see what I mean. I wish I could describe it better.
I have concerns.
Yeah, let me see if pantographic actually gives me a better pantographic. Mechanical linkage connected in manner based on parallelograms so that the movement of one, it's you know, like a pantograph is a tool that you could use.
Oh,
they basically,
I see.
They move like
okay.
Parallelograms. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. That makes sense. Yes. Yes.
Yeah,
I can't describe it in a way that our audience could visualize it. You'll have to look it up yourself. But I do know what that. Now that I'm seeing a picture of it, I'm like, oh, I understand what that means.
The crisscross squiggly squag. I don't know.
Okay, as somebody who used to be a Hawk Girl cosplayer, one of the popular ways of creating moving wings is essentially creating like a pantographic situation in order to do the hinges.
I guess that's true. Yeah, maybe like an old film camera, the way that it would like extend outwards would be on like a pantographic frame, or like a hydraulic press might even be pantographic in shape, and the way that it crisscrosses and, you know, look up pantographic. I don't know what to tell you. There were, again, a variety of different types of stories, variety of different types of monsters, and all the monsters often had like more comical than frightening traits to them.
Right.
And there was a greater emphasis placed on the behavioral traits And that's actually something that played into when they were trying to make the monster scarier, more horrific. They did what horror writers, storytellers have done since the beginning, where they did the less is more. And that's something
don't show the monster.
Don't show the monster. It's something we literally were talking about just with the cosmic horrors, is the less you know, the scarier they are, because you build that up in the back of your head. So there would be some where it's just like, oh, I know this guy, you know, Two Nose Bill down the street. He had one of them waddly wumps jump on his back, and he looked up at that thing, and he'll see that every day for the rest of his life. And you better thank God himself that you weren't there to experience that waddly wump, because that man is scarred. And he'll never tell you. He won't tell you what it looks like. He told me once, and that thing haunts my dreams. I see it at night, and I'm doing the Lord's work by not telling you. You know, that kind of storytelling where it's like...
Glowing red eyes, bright as the devil himself or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the glowing red eyes are important in cryptid lore.
They're so important. It's got to get glowing
eyes. It's not really encrypted if they don't have red glowing eyes. This is what I am learning from my time here on Monster Crush.
You gotta love that eye shine. It's important. Yeah. It definitely doesn't mean it's an owl. So that's basically what a fearsome critter is. Now, I have brought two fearsome critters for you today for you to decide on. And that's kind of the nice thing about fearsome critters, is that they typically don't have a lot to them. Their stories are often brief and to the point and comical. And, you know, like, so we've covered a handful of them here on Monster Crush in the past. We had the Slide Rock Bolter, which actually is one that I find particularly scary. If you're not familiar with that one, it is a whale-sized creature that looks like kind of like a giant anglerfish or maybe a giant whale, but it has like sharp teeth. And it has a hook tail and can camouflage perfectly into the rock of like the side of a mountain or a hill. It will do is detach its hook tail and slide down into a valley with its mouth open, catching anything it can in its mouth, and then go up the other side of that valley and hook its tail back to the other side of whatever this mountain is. So it will live in these little valleys. And it's terrifying to me because it's a living rock slide that eats you, and it's horrifying because just the thundering of that thing coming. I can see that in my head. I can visualize that, and I find that very scary.
I'm not taking that home to cuddle with at night. That's for damn sure.
That's fair. We have also done the Snallygaster, which technically is a fearsome critter. Fearsome critters also can be identified often by their affinity for drinking alcohol. The two that we have today don't necessarily partake in that, but if you ever find a monster where it's like, they drank 10 barrels of my finest ale, that falls into
How else do you explain the alcohol disappearing other than the monster drinking all of it and not the person who came up with the monster?
Exactly. So, Snallygaster is one. Bigfoot, there are some people who say that Bigfoot falls into the category. I don't necessarily stand for that.
No.
I'm trying to think if we've... I definitely know that there likely have been... the giant mosquito thing. What was that thing called?
The giant mosquito. Another one that I will not be taking home for pets, because mosquitoes can die in a fire.
The Gallinipper. The Averysboro Gallinipper. And that's another one you can definitely tell, because like it singles out a guy who, you know, braves the Gallinipper and like it sucks his blood out or something like that. And yeah, it's a whole thing where it's like, you know, a hawk sized mosquito or a man sized mosquito.
Upsetting.
But there's so many. There's so many weird ones out there that we will definitely be coming back to fearsome critters. But again, I have two for you today. Before we get to those, though, I do have some spooky news.
We have spooky news?
I have a lot of spooky news. So, spooky news for today. I have four stories. Two of them I'm really going to tie together. Okay. So, let me ask you this. Do you want to do aliens, ghosts, or Loch Ness Monster first?
Oh, let's save the Loch Ness Monster for last.
Okay. I could frame it this way. Do you want true crime? Or do you want, like, wow, outer space is neat?
You know, let's go to the true crime first, because okay. I actually prefer space things.
Yeah, so let's say, do bad true news crime first. We typically don't do true crime here on Monster Crush because it's kind of a bummer. And, like, it's not really our thing. It typically doesn't have to do with monsters. I don't know.
I'm not a true crime girly. Sorry.
There's other podcasts that do true crime so much better than us. Yeah, that we typically don't touch on it. But this is a story that involves a woman being found in a church, completely bloodless, where she's dressed as a vampire and was likely hunting for ghosts. So
ghosts and vampires.
Ghosts and vampires. This comes to us from Cairo 7, local Seattle news.
Oh.
Because it's gotten that far. Yeah, when I originally found it, it was like on Business Insider, but that was a few days ago. Uh-huh. I went ahead and looked it up again to see if they actually like given out the woman's name, and they have at this point.
Made the local news.
Yeah, incredible. The local Seattle news. So a 22-year-old French woman was found in an abandoned church in northern Italy. This was posted as of April 12th. So this was over the weekend. And she had told her family that she was going to look for ghosts, perhaps as a popular ghost hunting TikTok challenge, which is kind of like trending in France right now.
Okay.
This woman's name was Ariane Nathalie. It's L-A-I-S-N-E. I'm going to say Lezon, but Lezon? I don't know.
No idea.
And her boyfriend, Timba Sohaib, T-E-I-M-A-S-O-H-A-I-B, again, I'm doing my best on pronunciation there, were last seen in the town of La Salle dressed as vampires. She apparently, both of them, rather, had been asking residents about abandoned villages nearby where they could camp. Her body was found later that weekend in a church by a hiker. She was, I'm not going to go super into details because this is the gruesome part. And again, this is not necessarily what we do well. But she had been stabbed, shot, wounds to her neck, and was found completely bloodless. Mm-hmm. So now, the authorities are trying to figure out if this was a, quote, consented murder as a sacrifice because she was found bloodless. The boyfriend was arrested on Thursday and charged the quote here is, it is a classic femicide, the killing of a female because of her gender, motivated by the motives of possessiveness and control over the victim's will. That's what the Italian prosecutor said. So the person arrested in Lyon is seriously suspected of the crime of premeditated murder and other aggravating circumstances. So kind of a bummer there, but still, like, dressed as vampires, found bloodless, like, in...
They were ghost hunting.
While they were ghost hunting, and the state of her body apparently was indicative of some sort of sacrificial scenario. And I guess there's enough there to question whether it was, again, a consensual murder, whether there were defense wounds or if she was going along with this. So
definitely sounds like somebody was trying to make a ghost regardless, which I don't mean that in poor taste. No, like, people are weird. Like,
people are weird. And speaking of people are weird, the last line in this article is, her body was found in the church near a bag of pink marshmallows. Why Cairo 7? Why is that part of the details
here? Why are the pink marshmallows important?
Anyway, vampires and ghosts out of the way. Let's move on to some aliens. So, New Scientist needs to take down their paywall, but they had a pretty cool article headline, which I think is enough to just spurt on enough. they give you a little bit. They give you just a taste. I'm not subscribing. I'm not.
That's
fuck that.
Fair.
And I can't remember how to read this shit without buying it. So, the article headline is
University
Planets That Look Alike. Yeah, I
know
there's somewhere. It's fine. It's the article headline is, planets that look alike might be a sign of spacefaring aliens. We don't know what alien life might look like, but if other civilizations can colonize multiple worlds, we might see planets that look unusually similar. Sure. And I feel like that's kind of an interesting quality. It actually does tie into the next article I could find, which comes to us from the New York Times. So New York Times has an article that says she dreams of pink planets and alien dinosaurs. It's an article about Lisa Kaltenegger, who is the director of the Carl Sagan Institute at Cornell University. Mm-hmm. And she has a new book out where she talks about all the planets she's looking for and whether they'll have dinosaurs and whether they will be like covered in like bioluminescence, because she's studying the evolution of our planet and is trying to look for other planets who might be going through those same evolutionary stages at different points. And, you know, we have the James Webb telescope right now. What is that going to see if it goes out far enough? Because I don't know if you've ever heard this. If you, I believe it's if you look at our planet with like the strongest telescope possible from like the Andromeda galaxy, you know, one of the nearest galaxies to us, and you were to look at the planet Earth, you would still see dinosaurs because of how fast light travels.
Oh, shoot. Yes. Okay. Yeah. I believe I've seen something along those lines.
That, yeah. You know, I can't remember those exact details.
You know,
yeah.
If you look far enough out, like people can see the beginnings of Earth as a planet sort of situation because of the way.
Exactly. Yeah. Because light travels at a certain speed and it's not infinite. So at a certain distance, you'd still be able to see the light being reflected off of the Earth, which would still show a Paleolithic or even the Cretaceous period would show, a prehistoric time on the planet Earth. So, yeah, if we were to flex out hard enough, you could potentially see the light emitted from what is considered to be the Big Bang or, the dispersions from the Big Bang itself. So Kaltenegger has her new book, Alien Earths, New Science, Planet Hunting in the Cosmos, which is going to be published on April 16th, and just talks about her insights, her adventures spanning an idyllic childhood in Austria to her Cornell office. The office that she occupies previously belonged to Carl Sagan, so she's filling those big shoes perfectly well. She basically spoke about, her theories about what kind of life we're going to find out there, the research that she has done with certain aspects of life. She has some strong opinions on the dangers of fungus, or at least how fast fungus can spread. And apparently she did...
Fungus is scary, yes.
It is. Well, she apparently in this article she talks about doing an experiment with a pink fungus that was potentially somewhat alien in its composite. There's something strange about it, but the way that it spread so quickly, they basically had to terminate the experiment much earlier than they had imagined.
This is like a horror film,
right? Yeah, she literally says, "I just imagined a world overgrown with pink fungi." So, talks about...
The Last of Us is real.
Right? So she talks about, how when we did have dinosaurs, when we did have bigger animals, we had more oxygen and more methane. If we can find planets out there that have higher concentrations of oxygen and methane, would they also constitute larger animals as well? What would that evolutionary structure look like? Were they not to be hit with an asteroid? I find it really interesting, and especially in conjunction with finding alien planets that are colonized and all look similar, while we are looking out to the cosmos, what will we find? Will we find planets that do look similar and be able to trace those back like almost breadcrumbs to a civilization that has been colonizing places to make separate homes for us or for itself? Or will we find planets that are similar but different from ours and kind of, separate out these strange creatures? Anyway, a little bit of alien news that sometimes
I love that.
Brings a little bit of hope to things, right?
Hope and also terror, because I was talking to a friend about this. I love the idea of space. I'm a huge sci-fi junkie, and a lot of my favorite media is based in sci-fi. But I like explored space. The idea of unexplored space and the unknown is fucking terrifying.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Just the vastness of space is I think very similar to thalassophobia. The what is out there that we can't see.
It's overwhelming.
I think I was bringing this up the other day, the one quote of either we're totally alone in the universe or we're not. And, either one is equally terrifying.
It's true.
Yeah.
Both thoughts are scary.
Well, let's move on from aliens then. And talk actually a little bit about aliens, but also about Loch Ness, as NASA has been asked to help in the search for the Loch Ness monster. as the next big annual hunt for the Loch Ness Monster is about to begin. So we are looking at the 90th anniversary of the first organized surface watch of Loch Ness. That was Sir Edward Mountain's expedition. And the first expedition was in 1934. So we are looking at 90 years on now. And the organizers of the event have actually reached out to NASA. The article really goes on. It talks a lot about Loch Ness, how many sightings have been. You know, there's been 1,156 sightings since 1934. That's a lot. That's really cool. They talk about a lot of people that are kind of like getting together. It's volunteer based. They're bringing a lot of tech. Yeah, it's really awesome. The thing that I find kind of funny about this article, which comes from The Independent, is it talks about NASA at the very beginning. They don't really address NASA until the very end of the article, where they do talk to Amy Todd, who's the marketing manager for the Loch Ness Center. And she says that we're hoping that Nessie hunters around the world will help us reach the people at NASA. We're hoping to reach them through the power of social media. Sure. We're just hoping that their expert guidance to help with our ongoing quest to get answers. We have gone to UK universities as well. And this is second to last line of this article. We're hoping the experts from NASA might have some advanced imaging technology to scan the lock. We would have to sit down and talk to them about how to get it here. Right. They don't know what they're asking for. They don't know what they want. They're just like, NASA will help. NASA's great. Yeah, NASA's great. They've got
stuff.
They got lots of stuff.
Not the least of which is that they are, I feel like space and water are similar and yet different.
Similar, but that literally what we were just talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I mean, astronauts train in water tanks as opposed to... going into low atmosphere. So, yeah, maybe they do have some sort of scanning stuff to help. But I don't know that NASA will be stretching its resources to Loch Ness. I hope they do.
I hope so. I feel like it would be good for them.
Yeah, I feel like NASA could use some good press. Honestly.
Yeah.
At this point, it's been a while since we've really cheered on something that NASA did. If NASA found the Loch Ness Monster, we're going to like Jupiter next week. Like that's
truly.
What a win. Think about it, NASA. So that's all I have for spooky news. Some very good spooky news. Let's move on to our Sickletons here. Okay. So, again, I've brought you two Fearsome Critters today. I have brought you what I think are really good representatives of the Fearsome Critter community, that being the Hoogag and the Agro Pelter. So, let's...
okay.
Let's jump right in. Oh, they've got great names. They've got great names. These are some of the more mundane names as well. There's absolutely a Fearsome Critter called a Goofus that I did not bring in this
book. A Goofus?
There's Goofus. That's
the thing I love about Fearsome Critters. They have the best names.
They really do. Splinter Cat, Cactus Cat's one. There's the Pacific Northwest Tree Octopus. Yeah, there's some really...
I love the Pacific Northwest Tree Octopus. I'm familiar with that
fur-bearing one. Fur-bearing Trout, of course. Yeah, they're fantastic. So let's start with the Hoogag. The Hoogag, if you are not familiar, the scientific name, I use the term scientific with all of the asterisks I possibly can.
Right, of course.
Is Rhythmopes inarticulatus. Yeah, which will make sense in a second here. Not a lot of articulation to this particular cryptid, this monster. Okay. This is said to be a huge animal of the lake states, megafauna perhaps even, as it is often compared to a moose. The range of its habitat includes western Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, and a territory that extends indefinitely northward into the Canadian wilds towards Hudson Bay. It was first illustrated in the bestiary Fearsome Critters of the Lumberwoods, the 1910 book by William T. Cox. Mm-hmm. And Cox gives a great description of it. He says, in size, which like I said, the Hoogag might be compared to the moose. And in form, it somewhat resembles that animal. Very noticeable, however, are its jointless legs, which compel the animal to remain on its feet, its long upper lip, which prevents it from grazing. If it tried the method of feeding, it would simply tramp its upper lip into the dirt. Its head and neck are leathery and hairless. Its strangely corrugated ears flop downward. Its four-toed feet long bushy tail, shaggy coat, and general makeup give the beast an unmistakably prehistoric appearance. So we're talking about a moose-like animal, quadrupedal, but ain't got no knees. This thing goose steps everywhere it goes. And it has a really long upper lip.
I'm trying to picture this image, and I just, I mean, I know I have a photo reference, but I'm trying to like picture it based on what you have just told me, and I'm like, what?
Yeah, it's like a horse, but wrong.
A horse, but wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to
feel free to check out some of these pictures. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, sure. A horse that's, oh, one of those is just a prehistoric animal.
So that is true. So there's one of the
I just, I like very much recognize it as one of the, I very much, okay, so we have something that looks like a, it's not Shel Silverstein, but maybe it a little bit, or Where the Wild Things Are kind of monster.
For sure.
With, it looks like a moose with no knees or ankles, rather, because aren't the ankles actually what we, anyway, I don't know horse anatomy. And then like a really, really long face with no fur on it.
That's all lip.
It's all lip.
It's an upper lip that drags down there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like a lion's tail. And then the other one looks very sweet, actually, which, because this one has like big old spiky antlers and it looks very tall, very, very tall. But it is just a, like, it looks like a giraffe mixed with a deer with like a ball sack hanging from its legs and covered in floral arrangements.
That one's from a 2015 book.
I like this one.
Yeah.
And then the other one is very much just a picture of a prehistoric horse that I am sure I have seen before.
Yes. So the prehistoric horse, which I found to be kind of interesting that they are somewhat similar. You know, if you did actually have maybe somebody see these, there are a couple of prehistoric animals which kind of fall into that category. But the one that a lot of people point to is the Merapis, which is is that one is it's an extant relative of the horse. Yeah. And it kind of looks like a giant sloth in some ways, but a little more horsey, has hooves. So the other book, I can't remember the name of, but it was a 2015 book that also covered Fearsome Critters, and I have it.
It kind of looks like a camel face.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah.
The first picture.
But the hoogag, again, has kind of a tough time eating, but it does have a love for travel, which actually makes it really hard to hunt, apparently. Few hunters who have taken up its trail ever came up with the beast or back to camp because it just keeps moving. It it has a really tough time sleeping. It has to lean up against things just even sleep. So it's reported that
it doesn't have any knees.
Exactly. It can't light up. No knees. So it's reported to keep going all day long. It eats twigs, flopping its lip around trees and stripping bark as occasion offers. And at night, since it can't lie down, again, leans against a tree, bracing its hind legs and marking time with its front ones. Apparently, you can still hunt a hoogag. The most successful hoogag hunters, should you want to, you know, keep one for benevolent reasons, have adopted the practice of notching trees so that they are almost ready to fall. So that way, if a hoogag leans up against one, both the tree and the animal come down. And then after the tree's fallen on top of it, it can't get up. So you can...
Sure. Why not? That sounds great. Also, I love hunting hoogag. Sounds like a Dr. Seuss book.
It really does.
And
it does
look very Seussian animal situation.
And as I promised, there has to be a person connected to this. So apparently there is a record holder for the largest hoogag ever hunted, which was in Turtle River in northern Minnesota, where just a young one, so this is a juvenile, weighing 1,800 pounds, was found stuck in the mud. And there was a guy named Mike Flynn of Cass Lake who hit it in the head.
So, obviously.
Good on you, Mike.
I have so many questions. One being, how can you tell that you're hunting a hoogag versus, like, a moose, given that, like, I guess the if you're really good at tracking, that you could maybe see that the gate was off, but like I'm not sure that I buy that. And also, I don't know. Like, I feel like you just like dirty up a moose with no antlers and stuff, and it can look real strange, and they get stuck in twigs and whatnot, you know?
I don't know, LD. That sounds like the talk of a non-believer.
It might. Okay,
that sounds like fair. Some doubter bullshit.
And I don't know if you've ever seen like, I don't think I've ever seen a moose in real life, but when you look at how big moose are compared to like real objects that we see every day, I never think of, I mean, I know that they're big, but I don't think I ever realize quite how big they are until you see them like next to somebody's house or something. And you're like, Jesus.
I think living in America, we tend to forget what a megafauna is.
Yeah.
And that's something where, yes, the moose, the North American moose is the last remaining North American megafauna. And when you see it, you go, oh, that's what prehistoric people had to deal with. Oh, fucking I would have been fucked. Yeah. They're impossibly big. They're way too big. Also, while we're talking about moose, fun fact, moose are so big that, how big are they? They're so big that one of their main predators is actually the killer whale.
Oh, yeah, I did know that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There was a comic that went around online a little while ago.
Only that basically thing that talks can take about, out a moose, a killer whale.
Yeah, because moose will actually swim those down assholes. Up to like 20 to 30 feet and eat kelp at the bottom of lakes and rivers.
Ridiculous.
And, you know, things where orcas live, you know, in bays and things like that. And orcas will actually eat moose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those things are too big to swim, too. Like the fact that they can go down that far for kelp and shit is also mind boggling.
Yeah, well, there's even a theory that a lot of lake monsters in North America are actually just female moose, because when you talk about
that's fair, actually.
The head of a lake monster, they're often described as horse-like.
Yeah.
And if you look at a female moose.
That checks out.
So, to finish up with the Hugag, in the Limestone Valley, Pen Pictures of Early Days in Western Wisconsin by S.W. Brown, written in 1900, the author, Brown, actually describes the Hugag as having round feet surrounded on all sides by claws, which conceal its direction of travel. So, with that, you can't tell which way it's walking, so you can't really follow it. You don't know whether it's gone, you know, north or south.
Right, sure.
Yeah. He doesn't really give much detail other than that. But what's interesting here is that he does spell the name of the monster in a very interesting way that kind of, I think, gives away the joke. And he spells it H-E-W-G-A-G. So a person who chops trees might be someone who hews, and a joke being a gag. A hew gag. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So
good.
That's what I have for the Hugag.
I love it.
Let's talk Agropelter here.
Agropelter.
It's a great name.
It sounds like a Nerf gun from the 90s.
It's the Agropelter. Take out your little brother. Don't tell your mom. It's Nerf or nothing.
Exactly what that sounds like.
The Agropelter. Also, erroneously, and that's the word that I saw described for this word, called the Argopelter, if you're going to misspell it, has a number of pseudoscientific names. Anthrocephalus craniofractans, or Brachiopotentes craniofractans, or Papio Stretch Armstrongus.
Oh, good. Oh, great.
Also sometimes called the Widowmaker, these monsters are said to inhabit hollow trees of the conifer woods stretching all the way from Maine to Oregon.
Okay.
Long stretch of territory there.
All across the territory, great.
Anywhere you might find a lumberjack. So, the Agropelter is one of the more aggressive, I would say, of the fearsome critters.
I would hope so with a name like Agropelter, is all I'm saying.
It doesn't like anything crossing its path or coming into its territory, although I have also seen some people say it doesn't like anybody messing with the tree that it lives in. It lives in hollow trees. Don't mess with hollow trees. But other people say if you even get close, you're in danger. And they say if you come close enough, the Agropelter is going to hurl wood splinters and branches at you with lethal force.
force, yeah.
With mm-hmm. lethal force. Some have described the creature as a hairy humanoid similar to Sasquatch, but slightly smaller. However, that is, get that out of your mind. This is not a Bigfoot.
Not a Bigfoot.
This is something else entirely.
Okay.
So, to describe what an agripelter is, we actually need to go to the one gentleman who survived an attack from an agripelter, and I use gentleman loosely, because they are so accurate in their assault, so deadly with their, so lethal with their limb lobbing, that there is one reported survivor whose name is Big Ol' Kittleson. I've broken
all the... You almost made it with that seriously, too. I'm so proud of you. You were so into it, and then you said the name, and yep, that was it.
Big, old, spelled O-L-E,
Kittleson. Naturally, of course. Sorry, say that last name one more time.
Kittleson. You got to put the little emphasis in it.
Yeah.
Kittleson. Okay. So, Mr. Big Ol' Kittleson. He said that the only reason he survived his attack was because the agripelter had grabbed a rotten branch and it just shattered on his head and didn't actually kill him.
Sure.
So he turns around to look at this thing and sees it running off. And he sees that this thing has a slender, wiry body, the villainous face of an ape, and arms like muscular whiplashes. And it uses these arms to snap off dead branches and hurl them through the air like shells from a 6-inch gun.
Okay.
And for reference, a 6-inch gun are like the guns that used to be on like Navy destroyers back during World War II. Like a 47 caliber gun. So,
right.
Yeah, something that that used to be able to pelt through the side of a battleship is the force that these things are flinging.
Agropelter.
Agropelter.
It is what it says it is.
Yeah. So there's another reference that does not come from Big Ol' Kittleson. I don't know if somebody else survived. Or
I don't know if I trust it then.
Right? But they said the creature has the head of a gorilla or some other terrifying ape, but is fully furred, whereas a gorilla's face is, you know, doesn't have hair on it.
Right, not. Mm-hmm.
Its body is like that of a stretched out starving bear, and they are said to be completely black save for their face, which has a spoken ash gray skull pattern contrasting the black of the rest of the animal. That's fucking metal as hell.
I love him.
A skull, of awesome. Ashen skull design on an otherwise like black ape that's just flinging like 47 caliber like bark at you. That's incredible.
I mean, you know, when I said that it sounded like a 90s Nerf gun toy, I didn't think that I would also get the image of like, you know, true aggro 90s like nonsense with the skull paint and... Because that's what is happening right now.
This absolutely is. Some, like, Deadpool-esque shit. This is just, like, pouches everywhere and...
Yeah.
Oh, damn. So...
With, like, really long arms? They said whiplash arms, and so I just...
Yes.
I think of, like, Kermit noodle arms when I hear that, which is just wrong, but also not... Like, I'm like, big, long, wiry... Okay,
so wrong. Sure. I cannot emphasize to you how wrong we're actually going to get here. So...
Okay.
The agripelter subsists primarily on woodpeckers, barred owls, different types of birds typically, because it lives in hollowed trees. So it's typically looking for animals that also, you know, live in hollowed trees. That's what it eats.
Came out of their homes and eat them, sure.
Exactly. And it apparently eats rotten wood as well. It does procreate. This is an animal. And its pups are always born on, weirdly enough, February 29th. Leap year.
It's a leap year monster. Great.
And they arrive in odd numbers, usually 3 or 5. So we've gotten more agripelters.
I'm confused how people know this about this.
Right? I don't know. Well, you know. There's been intense study.
How do we learn about this if everybody dies who's ever encountered one, except for Big Ol' Kittleson?
That's some doubter bullshit, LD. God damn it.
I know. Who
Stop
am
bringing
I?
Just... logic into these fearsome critters.
Sorry.
Smokey Joe over there, he's rapping and rapturing you with his stories and his tall tales. You just got to sit there and just...
And I'm the new guy in camp who just is like, this sounds like bullshit to me.
You're like, shut up, you and your doubting bullshit. You'll see one.
But then in the middle of the night, I'll wake up and hear a noise and go, oh my God, it's the agripelter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it said they'll use anything as ammunition. They'll use branches, acorns, pine cones, fruit, even birds' nests, unfortunately for those birds.
Uh-huh.
One extra thing to the agriculture, to wrap them up, that I found actually really interesting is in one account, an agripelter is said to have kidnapped a pioneer surveyor and fed him raw fish until he was able to escape. And just like on the surface, that's funny. It's weird. It's just kind of like, okay, that doesn't really go with the rest of the story. But when we look back at our Sasquatch episode and we look back at one of the main like Sasquatch sightings out there, one of the sightings that kind of gets brought up a lot anytime Sasquatch gets brought up. When we Albert Ostman, who was a guy that was held captive for 6 days, supposedly, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, where he said that he was kidnapped by a family of Sasquatch, like force-fed raw fish, and was held like captive. It's this weird kind of parallel where we have a North American great ape and, you know, somebody being abducted, and Sasquatch often have abduction stories attached to them. I just felt like it was one of those weird kind of parallel things that I didn't want to necessarily ignore, and I wanted to make sure we touched on. But otherwise, that is what I have for the agripelter, and you are more than welcome to check out those lovely, high-quality JPEGs that I have sent you.
I mean, it is exactly what it sounds like, which is a monkey with, like, really long, noodly arms.
Absolutely.
Like an ape. Like, I mean, there's, you know, chimp-like qualities, gorilla-like qualities, orangutan-like qualities.
I will unfortunately reference you to the third image, as this also comes from the 2015 book that...
I don't like how many hands are happening with this.
So, in this iteration, the agripelter collects the hands of people that it kills and adds them to its arms. So the more people that piss it off, the deadlier it becomes as its arms get a greater whip-like quality.
So the noodly arms are just a series of hands.
In this version, yes. It's hands, hands holding hands.
You know, it's funny. When you directed me to this, I was sort of ignoring this particular picture because I saw the multiple hands. I was like, you know, I'm good.
It's Sweet Caroline-ing. It's hands... touching hands.
Holding hands. Yeah.
Reaching out.
God, touching.
Throwing bark. Killing you. Agro pelter. There we go.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, and some of them, like, they're a little more octopus-like. There's, like, the orangutan one that's almost wrapped around the tree. There's the last one is very noodly. That one, like, no hair on it really unsettles me.
It looks like what, so this other one looks like, it's a different kind of monkey. There's a monkey that does actually look like this with all of the hair on its face. Some fangs, but the hands are depicted in a way, the arms look like rat tails very specifically, but with like three fingers on the end of them.
Yeah.
That one I don't love.
Yeah. Five fingers on the feet though. So I find it here that weird. Mm-hmm. They've just got little night crawler hands.
Mm-hmm.
But that is what I have for y'all, dude. That's what I have for the Hoogag and the agripelter. So, what I will start with first here. Can we find either of these monsters sexy? Can we find either of these monsters lovable?
Like I said at the beginning of this, we called them critters to begin with, which automatically in my head has taken them very far out of the smoochable category.
Fair.
I could see perhaps maybe smooching the agripelter maybe, but like honestly, there's a lot.
Think about those hugs.
It's the thing is they've got a lot of arm to hug with, that's for sure. But I know that we're not comparing him or comparing the agripelter, but it's not compared to say Sasquatch, who is definitely the superior of the cryptids, and it's just like the agripelter just pales in comparison to Sasquatch, I feel. Although I do like that they have a very caring nature and will, like, feed somebody that they've kidnapped. That's lovely. The propensity for hurling things is not my favorite thing. I don't love stuff being thrown at me.
That's true. That's a level of aggression that's really not acceptable.
It's also why I didn't do a lot of sports in school.
Oh, also valid. Yeah.
You know, I did track when I did do sports. So, like, I didn't play the things were lobbed in my general direction.
Fair.
Generally.
Yeah.
So I feel like the aggro pelter is not necessarily it. On the other hand, I do, you know, I think the hoogag could be something that I could see myself, if I had the space for it, to take home and like have as a companion animal, maybe something that I could like ride to the grocery store on.
Oh, sure.
You know, it's a big, like, I don't know how well it, or how comfortable it would be to ride, given that it doesn't have any joints. But even still, just watching it, like, sort of lean out in the pasture, living its best life, would also be quite enjoyable, I feel. And frankly, it sounds like they'd be really inexpensive to feed, since they mostly just eat twigs.
Yeah, they just slurp whatever's off of a tree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I totally dig that.
And the really nice thing, they love to travel. Yeah. So, you know. And
they love to travel.
Vacations are going to be nice.
Yeah, I definitely could see lots of walks, mm-hmm. which is good.
Yeah,
I feel like I wouldn't want to smooch the hoogag necessarily.
It's a lot of lip.
Or like at all. So much. No.
It's a lot of extra lip. Yeah.
Lots of extra lip. But I do think they seem sweet. I would take it for a pet for sure.
That's a fair enough answer. That is a form of love in and of itself. Not everything here mm-hmm. has to be romantic. All right, Aldi, I love that answer, and I appreciate you. I hope you and the hoogag find a lovely time. I hope that you are able to not know whether it's going or well.
No, you're gonna finish that sentence.
Fuck. anyway, so I hope you'll have an absolutely fantastic time. Keep it away from trees that are about to land on it. And
right.
Yeah, I just, you know, keeping it from tramping over its own lip in the dirt, I guess.
I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be great. So thank you, LD. Thank you as always.
Hey, thank you, Derek. This has been a great, great fun. And while we're doing thank yous, a big thank you to Nick Lambert, our musician, the composer of our fabulous theme song. You can find more about Nick over at Lambert Tropolis on Instagram. And a big thank you to the Sword and Key Network, of which we are a member. You can find all of the links to Sword and Key at beacons.ai/Sword and Key. Sword and Key produces podcasts and TTRPG content. Look for Sword and Key with underscores between the words. Thank you, listeners, for coming and hanging out with us today. If you like Monster Crush, if you've enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, rate, and review. We may even read some of your reviews on here. Who knows? You can find us, by the way, on Instagram and Twitter and Blue Sky at Monster Crush Pod. And you can find all of our links on our link tree, which is linktree.ee/Monster Crush. I haven't done that in a couple of episodes, so I thought I'd bring it back.
Yep.
Uh-huh. From there, you can tweet at us, send us an Instagram DM, join the Monster Crush chat over on Sword and Key's Discord, or email us. Who knows? So tell us your Monster Crush, what monsters you'd like to hear about in future episodes, and share your own spooky experiences with us. We might share them. We might not, but we might. Who knows? And a big also shout out from me personally to Friday Afternoon Tea, as I am an affiliate. Friday Afternoon Tea is our favorite tea shop in the Pacific Northwest, the only place that you can find Smut Tea, which is a tea that I collaborated with Friday. It is lubricating and spicy and all things smutty. You can get 10% off your tea order using the code THELADYDAME. All right. I just want to say last is the last name. Stay Wily.
Biggle,
I think we're going to go back... stay Biggle Kittles. Actually, I was going to say Stay Wily. Stay Wily.
You know,
as a callback to the very beginning of this episode.
Everyone loves a callback. Stay Wily. Keep those stories spreading. You saw something out there and no one would believe you, but you know what you saw.
I really hate the way that you just said keep those stories spreading.
Well... You know what? if your legs are named stories, then who am I to tell you what to do? Thank you, everybody. Take care of yourselves. Bye. browses on Twigs. I don't think that's the right verb.